Group meeting, Friday, 9th March, 1984. As you already know, we have spent several months in trying to free the mind from all sorts of superstitious ideas and beliefs and convictions and so forth, which will not stand a careful, reasonable scrutiny. Most of these beliefs are imposed upon individuals, upon people in the world, because they are the children of their parents, they are the pupils of their teachers, and they are the members of their particular society. These things come down through the ages, and I mean ages, 3, 4, 5,000 years. So these ideas and beliefs and the particular picture that is presented of them are false ideas and beliefs. So the importance of ridding ourselves of misconceptions of truth makes the person fit to directly see the truth for himself. And that direct seeing of the truth for oneself is not merely a mental conceiving. It is being actually conscious of that reality. Now, for example, we are perfectly conscious, constituted as we are, and as far as our consciousness has developed, we are perfectly conscious of the finiteness of all objects and people and creatures and the things which, as we say, fill our universe. So we are conscious of them as finite. But as and when consciousness in the human kingdom is able to come to its fulfillment, it will be conscious not in terms of finitude, that is to say, it won't be restricted to being conscious in terms of finitude, but it will also be capable of being conscious of infinity. We have the word infinity. We have the word eternity, the word immortality. And we have ideas about those things. But we are not conscious of them in the full sense. If we were, we would live that kind of life which completely expresses infinity and immortality and so forth. Now, obviously, this is not the case. If it were the case, we wouldn't be meeting here. And in all likelihood, we would have ceased to be separate, particular individuals as such. So we have spent the months from September onwards in examining very critically some of these firm, established, cherished beliefs. And we saw, or at least I hope we saw, that the form in which they have been presented must be discarded. There is an underlying truth which is only spoiled by the garb, the conceptual verbal garb in which these truths have been presented. So our task in evolution is so to develop that we become conscious of the actuality as such. And that, of course, spells the development of consciousness. Now, today, we might consider together this question of action. We think of action atomistically. By that I mean we think of any action as a separate little bit. And so many thousands, millions, countless actions which make up the world to us really are so many countless separate little bits of action. Now I use the word action because that is one of the meanings of the word karma. Karma is action, coming from kri, which means to create. Don't bother about the dictionary meaning of kri, because that's restricted to words which come out of minds, however clever they may be, which are completely confined to the realm of the finite and the mortal. They don't know the immortal as such. But kri really means to create. I have dealt with this several times in past years, so I won't go into it again. But karma then really means action, and it represents the entire living process of the universe, which is an active living process, isn't it? That's what karma represents. Now, what we see as bits is the whole of this action process of the cosmos. That is what it is in actuality. But we never see the actuality. We don't see this living process of the cosmos as a complete whole. What we are conscious of when we are completely well and healthy and whole within ourselves, what we are conscious of in holistic terms is our own body. When the body is perfectly well and you don't sort of have to think about it. You are aware of it as a whole thing. And the bulk of people in the world who are well and healthy, to them the word self or I represents the body. This is me. And as such, that is a perfectly straightforward, truthful statement. There's no doubt about it. When this whole me, which is the whole healthy body, gets ill, then we begin to think about parts of the body instead of the body as a whole, instead of being conscious of the body as a whole. Now, as and when our own consciousness is able to reach its culminating point, the culminating point for the human organism, remember, doesn't apply to any other states of being which may be transcendent to our human state. When it is when it has evolved far enough to be conscious in terms of wholeness, then it will function as a unitary whole. Just as we can exercise, we can be conscious in terms of unitary wholeness with respect to our own body when it is healthy and perfect, so to say. Now, this unitary wholeness, consciousness in terms of unitary wholeness, is one of the meanings of the phrase which theistic religions use, the omniscience of God. Now, where all the theologies of the world have failed is in trying to expound in some detail what is meant by the omniscience of God. They present it as God knows every single separate thing. He doesn't. Assuming the word God stands for the ultimate reality, He doesn't know every separate thing in terms of separateness. He is unitarily conscious of the wholeness of the cosmos. Now that is something entirely different from what for the last 4,000 years the theologies and philosophies of religion have presented. Of course, I may be wrong. But then, that's for you to find out. Perhaps if you really try to find out, you might find I'm not very far wrong in this matter. It is an all-inclusive consciousness, not merely as an external observer, but as being that which is observed, as doing that which is done. The unitary wholeness of transcendence functions and manifests in terms of being and doing that of which it is conscious. It is the totality. Now, when action is over, and now we'll come back to our ordinary everyday state, when action is over, karma is finished. It is finished altogether if that action is a complete, whole action. But if you examine life and examine oneself, if we examine our own self very, very carefully, we will see that almost never in our lifetime do we carry out an action which is whole and complete in itself. And if and when it is whole and complete, that karma is at a complete end. It has given birth to other things. That karma is not finished, except insofar as there is a memory of it. All our actions, whether of the mind or of the body, they are remembered. There is a memory storage in us. And also, except when it affects environment and society, then that karma isn't finished. It has affected the environment, it has affected other people. And so it goes on and on and on and on like that. Action never ceases, therefore, for one thing. But unfortunately, the going on is not in terms of fulfillment, not in terms of perfection or holiness or wholeness. It is in terms, that is why we have this perpetual dukkha, this sorrow in the world. Because action is incomplete. It is not whole. Now, this memory acts in several ways. We remember our action of a certain sort, we'll say, some time ago, a great time ago, many years ago, right from our young days, and so forth. We remember it. And one of the things that memory can do is that it can save us from repeating a previous mistake. That is possible. But unfortunately, it's a possibility which only few realize and put into practice. We repeat our mistakes over and over again, don't we? Look into our own, we must look very calmly and critically into our own lives and see that when we repeat an action which we did in the past 3, 4, 50, 100 times, we find that we haven't learned anything very special out of that experience. Only the intelligent person, only the serious-minded person who really wants to live and realize what it means to be a true human being, only he can save himself from repeating the previous mistake. Then again, another way in which memory acts is in developing or spoiling or hindering. It can work both ways. In developing a technique, a capacity for skillful right action. For example, take the ordinary things that we do. When we learn something, say learn to play a musical instrument, we practice again and again, we repeat the effort, and all the time our memory of the previous time helps us to get a better and a better result, and so forth. So memory of action can help us develop a technique and a capacity for skillful right action. Practicing the piano, for instance, the skill in games, immense amount of practice all along. Your athlete, and so forth. He has to practice all the time, otherwise he's done for. And then again, in scientific experiments, there is a repetition of the experiment hundreds of times in order to make certain that what one thought was the fact of the action, the reaction in the laboratory, is quite true. So there is repetition there, you see. And for that repetition, there has also to be memory. One remembers that, oh, when it was done on such and such a date, it produced such and such a result, and it wasn't quite all right. There were flaws in it, and so forth. And so the memory helps in that way. And with all our bodily actions, from birth onwards, all our bodily movements, our bodily skills and techniques and so forth, are developed through memory. What we did wrong somewhere, the little child doesn't lift its leg properly over something on the floor, and it has a tumble, and so forth. It remembers that, you see, and by repetition and the use of its memory, it learns how to use its body in the right way. Now, with respect to the action of memory in saving one from repeating a previous mistake, it may do that, or that memory may incite one, it may incite us to repeat the action in order now to obtain the desired satisfaction one failed to obtain the previous time. People go on doing the same thing again and again in order to get a desired result. Again, after the action, memory is there because of the incompleteness of the action. This is one of the important points. An action is not only a material doing. We must bear that in mind very carefully. An action involves considerable psychical activity too. Desire, pleasure, fear, attraction, revulsion, love, hate, gain, grasping, etc. An action involves all these factors at play, psychical factors, psychological factors. It also involves consciousness. Is the consciousness functioning as a pure and complete awareness or is it self-centered, isolative, separative? Every action involves all this. Materially, the body, the psyche, in terms of the desire and all the rest of it, and consciousness itself. If the consciousness is obstructed by a conditioned brain, it will not be an impartial, true seeing awareness. If it is obstructed by the psyche, consciousness will be clouded over by illusions, like a fly enwrapped in a spider's web, and there will be no chance for choiceless awareness, for enlightenment. The enlightened one is always choicelessly aware. He is awake to the whole karmic process, the action process of the universe. That doesn't mean that he is that your yogi or your Buddha or Bodhisattva is aware of what is happening on Mars or Jupiter or on some distant galaxy, or not that sort of thing. But within one's own environment, one is well aware. You see, one is choicelessly aware when consciousness has reached its peak point, its perfection, in terms of unitary wholeness. You can also be aware, and you have to be aware, in the ordinary, finite and temporal way, as long as one lives bodily in the world. There is no escaping from that. If one didn't, your yogi or whoever it is would be a confounded nuisance to the people around him. He wouldn't do the necessary things which he must necessarily do by virtue of having a physical body. He must eat, he must drink, he must eliminate, he must wash, he must do all these things, you see. So, and these are all finite, temporal things. Therefore, his consciousness is able to function perfectly in the finite and temporal sphere, and also function in the infinite, eternal sphere. Now, you know, the hint of this was given, I think, most perfectly by the Buddha when he taught the different states of jhana. After the first four states of jhana, the other four are called samapattis, which are, mistakenly translated as attainments. They are not attainments. In terms of the infinite and the eternal, there is nothing to attain or achieve. That is all absurd. That only belongs to this finite mortal sphere. I would say that the translation which is given in Sanskrit is probably a better one. It is a coalescence of consciousness, of the limited vijnana, the vijnanic consciousness with the transcendent complete consciousness, which is the unitarily whole consciousness. He gives the hint when he says, and then by the going down of all sensory perceptions, you know, at the end of the fourth jhana, he says that, he enters upon and abides in the condition, the ayatana, of the infinity of akasha, and then the infinity of vijnana. Now there, he used words which I don't think have been sufficiently understood since he taught these things. Probably his own people around him did understand, but as the centuries passed by, this was forgotten, this was not understood anymore. Because infinity and eternity completely negate, without destroying, the finite and the temporal. Which implies that in every finite and temporal manifestation, an atom or a galaxy, a mosquito or a Buddha, you see, the totality of infinity and eternity functions through the everything. Now you see, the brain cannot picture it. Can you? You try. Try and picture it. That the totality of transcendence is in every single particular, every single separate thing throughout the universe. Now you see, I suggest this is one of the reasons why, that is, I'm assuming the truth of what I'm saying, the actuality of what I'm saying. This is one of the reasons why everything in the universe is a holographic representation of the cosmos. You see, we people have got to the point in the past of saying that we are microcosms. They used the right word, microcosmos. But they didn't understand just what it implied. The microcosmos completely holds within itself, in potentiality at least, the totality of the macrocosmos, the whole cosmos. That means that the finite holds infinity in potentiality in it, and the temporal holds eternity within it. And this is not just a thought, an idea. You have to, one has to sort of get that flash of lightning, that lightning flash of something indescribable, an insight which is so profound that it utterly transforms your entire outlook upon the two contexts as I have presented them. Finite and temporal on the one hand, infinite and eternal on the other hand. But they are not two contexts. They are two contexts merely because I'm talking. I can't talk in terms of unitary wholeness. All words, all concepts, all image-making faculty and everything is gone. It's not there. You can't. It's the imaginative mind, which makes all sorts of conceptual, verbal formulations to represent that unitary wholeness. And of course it fails. You can't represent that unitary wholeness. You never see it merely. You become it. And you do it in everything without the brain knowing it in the limited manner in which the brain knows things. Namely, mental images, thought forms, ideas, conceptions, and words. Is this too troublesome? we'll persevere with it, and we'll get there. Persevere with it. Now, I said that if consciousness is obstructed by a conditioned brain, and everybody's brain is a conditioned brain, even the brain of a Buddha, simply because the physical body, Siddhartha Gautama, or in the case of Jesus or whoever it is, the physical body of necessity suffers from conditioning from the moment of birth onward. In fact, whilst in the fetus itself, whilst one is just the fetus, unborn, conditioning begins. All the influences at play, the food and drink of the mother, the rest, activity, the thoughts, the emotions, the whole of the external environment is conditioning this new life which is growing. All the time that happens. You cannot escape the conditioning. And again, even the perfected Holy One cannot escape that conditioning which prevents him from fully putting forth the fact, the truth as such. You can experience it. What the perfected Holy Ones have done and can do is that their words, which are really prophetic speech, stimulate the listener if he is serious, if he is keen upon it. It stimulates the listener in such a manner that the process of realization of this unitary wholeness begins to flower out, begins to grow. That's what can be done. Now, our consciousness as we are, being what it is, states of mind, moods, feelings, thoughts, speech, and daily deeds will be anything but pure, true, wise, good, loving, beautiful in the supreme sense. It's a funny thing, but Roman Catholicism was not far wrong. I say it was very much, very much right, saying we are miserable sinners. And I don't suppose the Catholic world itself really understands what it means. The best of them don't understand it. You see? We are sinners in this way, that all our thinking, feeling, speaking, doing is an activity which at best only partially preserves the unity of the universe, but usually, on the whole, it tends to hurt, destroy, break up, split up the unity of the universe. You see, this is why there is dukkha, otherwise there wouldn't be. There is suffering because of that splitting up. This consciousness with which we are born that way, this consciousness is the sinner insofar as it is unaware of unitary wholeness. Therefore, everything, the mode of awareness in terms of finitude and temporality is perpetuated by every human being who is born. The Buddha, Jesus, Zarathustra, all of them went through this. But they happened to break through the shell. They happened to realize this extraordinary state of consciousness, which is fully awake to the unitary wholeness of the universe. And it is because of that, that the energy, the power of infinity and eternity functioned freely through them, as freely as it could through them, because there was always the limitation imposed by the physical body and the brain, in order to help mankind onward. So, if you understand this, you will see that all my heresies, which I have been doling out since last September particularly, are not heresies at all. All the great teachers were themselves tremendous heretics. They denied the accepted, this, that or the other accepted belief of the day, this, that or the other accepted religious practice or mode of living of their day. They went forward, and a certain amount forward only. And that is all. We must be very careful. Let not seeing the fact prevent one from being as fully devoted, as fully loving, as fully reverencing as possible where the great teachers are concerned. All honor to each and every one of them. They did something absolutely marvelous. But we mustn't get cobwebbed by our feelings in the matter. The feeling is a good feeling, and it has to be there, otherwise you'll never get along. You see, that has to be there. But don't let that spoil true vision. The vision of the truth is absolutely essential. So, as I say, consciousness, our consciousness being what it is, our life is anything but the perfect life. It is anything but human. That is why I have, for years now, used this word subhuman. We are still subhuman. We are... Life is trying... The universal process, which is karma, this living process of the universe is action. It is this karma which is steadily pushing everything towards its fruition. So, how do we move out of this state of being blind children of mortality into the state of truth-seeing, deathless humanity? From bondage and sorrow into freedom and bliss. Very simply, use the senses rightly and fully. As long as one lives, use the senses rightly and fully as possible. Don't indulge them, driven by whims, passions, and fleeting impulses, driven by half-witted idealism. I'm going to follow in the footsteps of the Master is one of those absurdities which has plagued mankind through the ages. You can't follow in the footsteps of the Master. And you never should follow in somebody else's footsteps. You make your own footprints. That is your responsibility. You are an individual. You are unique. There is no one in the world like any one of us, or anyone anywhere else. And we have to live our own life to the fullest extent in as perfect a way as our own vision makes us see perfection. This is extremely important. You will find that action in the whole world will undergo a complete transformation if they begin to see this kind of thing. So, putting what I've said in another form, be wholly observant, completely observant. This includes being completely and skillfully active. Because action, in the real sense, which in this case I'm talking of the total action, the psychological, spiritual, and the bodily, the material action. Vision need not require physical action in this, that or the other situation. You only need to see the thing, really see it. see not as a mental perception by a clever observer apart from what you're seeing. You have to see it so that you are completely united with it in consciousness. Then that is the seeing which works miracles. The miracles of the Holy Ones, which are attributed to the Holy Ones, Jesus, Ramana Maharishi, and all sorts of people like that, you see, that they perform miracles. It is because that consciousness in that particular situation and circumstance of the healer was such that a transcendent energy worked. There is a great reality in something which I spoke about years ago here, and we had one or two meetings where I expounded what I call spiritual induction. You know, you have magnetic induction. If you take a magnet and just do that over a piece of steel a few times, several times, that piece of steel will also display magnetic properties. It will be magnetized, as we call it. And this is called magnetic induction. And you have electromagnetic induction and things like that, you see. Now, there is spiritual induction. You know, when you are in the presence of, say, one of the great Tibetan teachers and so forth, what happens to your own being undergoes a peculiar change, doesn't it? It's the spiritual induction by the teacher upon the disciple. So, be wholly observant, which includes being completely and skillfully active. Clear seeing means being truth conscious and right doing. That's what clear seeing really means. Not just having an idea, a thought, or a feeling. Now, when that happens, then there is no leftover. Nothing left undone. No karma to be worked out. The action is whole and complete. Where there is complete action, there is pure consciousness. Omniscient mind needs no memory.